Dear Elizabeth Robbins, it's been 20 years, has it not? Not 20 years since you last engaged my attention, but 20 years since the first my biography of you was published, and almost 20 years since I last addressed you directly as a public event. Other recognitions have come after. That's the great news. You've been republished and web-published. Your works are anthologized and taught and written about. In some cases, you have even been disambiguated from your countrywoman Elizabeth Robbins Pennell, who married the sketch artist. Isn't that significant? Every chance I get to explain you to others, I feel that I am still introducing you to audiences for the first time. Yes, despite the growing scholarship, there are those who have no idea who you are or how to place you. If we just tell them, American actress in London, first Hedda Gabler, 1891, first Hilda Vongel, 1893, that should be a start, should it not? Just last month, I was given only 500 words to document your stage career for the Routledge Encyclopedia of Modernism. And thanks to a bold editor, we pared down my profile of you and cut out what to me is all the interesting and neglected richness of your theatrical enterprises. I am so conflicted. I need to say something fresh on you, and now I find that even my quotation from your suffrage novel has been used as the title in a 2010 article. But I am still keeping my title. And in a later aside, I will prove that I marked and claimed the importance of Hilda harnessed to a purpose long before a prolific professor from Anglia Ruskin University appropriated and misidentified which of your characters that quotation was referencing. I confess I should have been keeping a more organized bibliography of scholarship on you. A little cut. Let me catch you up. 20 years ago, there was the Small Run University Press biography that, yes, is a reworking of my dissertation. And there were those who came before. If I had a longer time slot, I would do more than chant out their names, starting with Jane Marcus and Gay Gibson Sema and Mary Heath. Then I would make sure to include Carol McKay, Jane S. Gabin, Catherine Kelly, Sheila Stowell, and your bibliographer, Sue Thomas. And I've extracted something here. You can look on my research activity where I summarize. What's there to add that is new? Penelope Farfan has done a better job than I could do in these 20 minutes to show how you abandoned Ibsenism and then drafted your brilliant and now much anthologized early suffrage drama, Votes for Women. But time is of the essence. We learn that late in life, do we not? Yes, indeed. Remember your diary entry of December 1927, a good 25 years after you gave up stage roles? You were recording your impression, having watched from backstage what Ruth Draper's monologues made you realize. Amazing simplicity of external equipment, you diaried, an object lesson all through, in her art, in her theory of life of high economy. Deep impression made by this. Had I had it 30 years ago, what couldn't I have done? Alas, no theory of high economy struck you with enough force and soon enough to ease the task of your biographers. Ruth Draper developed her economy by creating in her mind those characters she addressed as if present. I have more than once addressed you as present in my book's epilogue, in my faculty scholar lecture delivered at the University Library in Jacksonville, Alabama. It was there that I teased my audience by reading more love letters from John Masefield than his heirs allowed me to publish. I learned that trick from Linda Wagner Martin, who announced at an MLA session that what she was about to say about Sylvia Plath could never see print. Those tricky little restrictions on permissions to publish. I would be reopening old wounds if I say to a fresh audience here that it was rather unusual not only to limit the number of words I could quote from Masefield's letters to just 100, but also to restrict the number of copies of my book that could be printed. I could offer to write the Masefield estate on our behalf. Do not worry, I'd tell them. But let us begin afresh, dear Elizabeth. Through most of your life, you lived at least two lives. This is not unusual for a woman of the stage who also saw that an actor-manager system limited your artistic potential. I've mentioned that you recognized long before James O'Neill did that it was like death to be trapped by melodrama, as he was in Count of Monte Cristo, which you playing opposite him in the early years. You knew enough to escape. But I just recently discovered this this confirmation about your attitude towards the melodramatic parts that, after all, did pay some of the bills. Opposite the portrait of you as Hilda, sensational enough in its day, in the Cassell's Universal Portrait Gallery of 1895, is this text, that after Hedda Gabler of 1891, you were tempted into the paths of melodrama. Fortunately, however, the lapse was not a long one. They say you were saved by being awarded the part of Claire in Henry James's play The American. Cassell's goes on. Here again a veritable triumph was achieved. Then more praise on the playing of the role of uncommon subtlety. Then jump to 1893 and another New Woman by Ibsen. Of the master builder, your portrait biographer concludes by saying that the excessive difficulty of the leading part proved to be but another opportunity for Miss Robbins, and she was acclaimed on all hands as the ideal Hilda Vongel, the role in which our portrait represents her. So, was it to escape from the professional degradation of the commercial actress that made you pursue Ibsen roles, or did you also want to be a director-playwright? Were you really seen as such a difficult company lady that you scrutinized every contract and looked for ways to write into the arrangements your license to perform elsewhere? That's like trying to break the studio system in the golden days of Hollywood. I'd not want to characterize you as such a maverick without also including that whimsical comment you wrote to Florence Bell in 1902 about the irony of your coming back around to perform under George Alexander's management. So then, given Penny Farfan's definitive chapter on you in her book Woman, Modernism, and Performance, does even a closer study of more of your experiences on the American and English stage merit examination? Aside from your Ibsen roles, do I say that you undertook some of the more radical experiments of the 1890s, that you performed the controversial Allen's Wife? Oh, that's been written about by others as well. Ellen Diamond, Catherine Wiley have lots to say about your daring portrait of a mother who smothers her deformed infant and welcomes her death sentence. Even more significant in my mind is that you were a central force behind the New Century Theater. It was not merely the disappointment of Ibsen's last play, which cooled your acting ambitions. Lingering illnesses after surviving typhoid on a trip to Alaska in 1900 caused you to reconsider your commitments after nearly collapsing from a performance 2 years later. I can sense you just urging me to take time to remind this audience that you initiated a collaboration with Sir Edward Burne-Jones to adapt a Rossetti poem, Sister Helen, or that you worked with Henry James to make more conversational a translation of Mariana. Mariana, now that is a role in a production that deserves some scholarly attention, all of it wonderfully archived in your collection of papers, right down to the seating chart for the subscription audience. Yet another secret avenue of escape beckoned, of course, in hopes you could earn a bit on the side by writing fiction. Fiction would be off topic for this audience, Elizabeth, but just know that in my head I see your many volumes of stage fiction especially had connections to your acting life. I'm going to skip a section here in which I detail the novella based on her friendship with Stella Campbell. I will have something to say about her published stage fiction in a minute. Yet, staying on topic, perhaps we should mention that Shaw accused you of sitting on the performance of Little Eyolf, not allowing anyone else to produce that Ibsen. Then, when you did, he more or less hinted it was your fault that it got disastrously recast. That Ibsen play, so long anticipated, that the redirected by you series of matinees expanded to an evening run at a commercial theater. It was a commercial management that dumped Janet Achurch and replaced her with Mrs. Pat, who was your rat wife. And she then performed the tortured Rita almost too pleasantly. That now would make an episode in itself, but surely you remember that was my first conference paper? When you came to write of others in Ibsen and the actress, you rightly recalled Janet Achurch's greater triumph as Lunda's first Nora, then hinted there were difficulties in casting John Gabriel Borkman. I have not really mentioned this in public before, but isn't it strange that researchers not only get the urge to read your works, to publish scholarship on your career, but also to remake you by inserting you into their own plays or novels? The last time I was in Ohio to stay, I visited Janesville for what the Historical Society allowed us to call Elizabeth Robbins Day. After all, it is your childhood home, the Stone Academy, that is now their headquarters. My effort for the proceeding was to announce the online edition of Open Question. Now, mind you, this was back in the day of the first public domain text at Project Gutenberg. This was when we typed everything keystroke by keystroke before scanning technology made it possible to see photo images of the original pages. Perhaps I wasted years of research effort on you, presuming the electronic editions of your copyright-free books would remake your reputation. There, in Zanesville, we were entertained by a brilliant performance by an actress impersonating you, your very young self, and all dressed in white, as I recall. The researcher who brought me this second time to your childhood home, Judith Bechtel, the real organizing force behind our Robbins tributes, had earlier traveled half a day on a bus to go to New York to see you as a created character in the Maria Irene Fornes play, Summer in Gossensass. It wasn't very good, she said, even though its concept of Marion Lee and Elizabeth Robbins waiting to stage Hedda Gabler did get a write-up in the New York Times of April 23, 1998. Having since been published and having gotten a fresh production at the University of Missouri last fall, Maria Fornes' play might deserve a mention, at least alongside the prolific novelist David Lodge, who in Author allows us to experience Henry James' first night of Guy d'Homville through your eyes. Fornes is not the only playwright scripting you into their fantastic imaginations. Betty Craig has done it with Learning from Elizabeth. Her play is a dialogue between two women of the theater whose mothers go insane. Sounds self-indulgent, sounds narrow, but Betty Craig has done her homework and, like you, has agonized about her own genetic inheritance. She captures your kindred spirit and has some insights to offer about how people like you and people like Ruth Draper and even people like Henry James get so hooked on the creative impulse to make something happen in front of an audience. To dedicate one's life to that as actress, playwright, director, memoirist, that's the mystery. Can I finally confess that I once tried it as well, wrote you into a play of mine. It was long before I knew you so intimately by reading all the unpublished material in the NYU archive. But my play is at least as earnest an effort as that of Miss Fornes. Since we are conjuring up spirits this weekend with the theme of first actresses and paying tribute to Christopher St. John, who did it so well, why not a bit of self-indulgence into my own creative past? My two-act play is titled Hedda and Hilda and I, and my I is, of course, you, Elizabeth Robbins, you as a character in my play. The first act begins at the end of your Ibsen years. You, along with a few others who read and speak Norwegian in London, have gathered at the stage of the Haymarket Theatre December 16, 1899 for the mandatory copyright performance of When We Dead Awaken. I know, it is the epicenter of your disillusionment with Ibsen as a playwright, but listen, once the seats are cleared and you send William Archer and Mr. and Mrs. Brekstead off to file the paperwork, you are visited by the spirits of Hedda and Hilda. With them, you relive your triumphs earlier in the decade. You banter with George Bernard Shaw and Henry James. Hilda steps forward to recreate her magnificent last scene. Each of your spiritualized heroines reassures you that your efforts to stage Ibsen plays have not been in vain. And together, you agree there's a future out there. The one other thing I would have included, if I had known of it, would be your Hedda's feather boa. If there are any photos that capture your crazed Hedda, they are this set of three studio shots with your Hedda's landmark costume accessory. If I were really into the spirit of performing as Ruth Draper, I'd use one now to mimic the way you entice your Atea into your grip. If I were theorizing about feminist performance or female friendships, I could speculate a lot. I suspect you'd just remind me not to forget to mention that you and Marion Lee, the two of you, almost pulled off a production of Twelfth Night in the Inner Temple. But I digress. Intermission, my act two. The future, where to go from there. You only acted twice professionally after 1899. Of course, act two of Hedda and Hilda and I is set almost exactly 10 years later. Remember that Hilda come knocking on the door is 10 years after her girlish appearance in The Lady from the Sea? You are one of the leaders for women's suffrage. Not just your play, Votes for Women, but your speaking, your essays in the press are your mission now. Your speechifying self is the key, really, to how the actress has a second act. And speak you did. Moreover, the speeches, along with the letters and pamphlets you published, collected together with brief timelines that wove all your effort into a narrative, spoke the new language, the language not of the Ibsen woman caught up in the hysterical moments of self-recognition about complicated connections in the past. No, this was a voice that spoke a new imperative, that women as a class have those inalienable rights, not just to vote, but to be treated with full equality. So, Act Two, and it is December 1909, and you have just been thrust into leadership of the WSPU. The setting is their offices. There's an exit up to the roof, which is where those in the leadership had the habit of hiding anyone the police came looking for when the offices routinely got raided. You frequently deliver speeches like your heroine was so unused to doing, but it did so exquisitely. You have just published Why. It will later form the central essay of this collection of essays and speeches to be published as Way Stations. But just now, a more immediate crisis is at hand. The crisis of forcible feeding. Hedda and Hilda enter your world from the roof as your free spirits, your more daring selves, and guide you. And here I had to take a slight creative license. I make you both a friend of Lady Constance Lytton and one who has knowledge of her plan to disguise as a common seamstress that will come just a few weeks later. Your main task is to announce to Constance that the government has just that day won a trial for the right to continue their practice of forcible feeding. She's already been arrested, but as the daughter of an aristocrat was quickly released. You'd like to persuade her that it is too risky to attempt a lower-class woman's disguise just to test their tactics. It is my second act, Hilda, the new Hilda, 10 years after my Act One Hilda, who reminds you how you put her spirit into the suffrage novel 2 years earlier. I am telling you this because I just want to establish that my never-produced play laid claim to the quotation from your suffrage novel that forms a part of this, of the title for this talk, Hilda Harnessed to a Purpose. Sometimes we scholars do not work methodically. We get inspiration that comes from far back, and we want better to know in our years of aging just where we got it from. Yes, indeed. Here the passage is attached to the pre-word process typescript with copyright 1978 on its title page. My Hilda of my second act reminds my Elizabeth, that's you in 1909, that your brilliantly coined Hilda Harnessed to a Purpose in The Convert, your novel that grew out of your successful court theater play, Votes for Women. It was such a clever tip of the hat to your magnificent performance and the impact it had on your 1893 audiences that my playwriting self of 1978 could not resist. Hilda Harnessed to a Purpose, youth knocking at the door. And I think I am the only one of three scholars quoting the passage who correctly identifies your character Ernestine Blunt as the brilliant young speaker, and that she is most likely modeled on the real-life labor leader and suffragette Mary Gawthorpe. Now, how might Ruth Draper handle what I wanted to be a substantial section on the fascination some of us developed for your never-printed and never-produced plays? Could I speak in her chopped and self-censoring dialogue to say, ground already covered? See the co-authored paper with Jane Gabin? Look these titles up in the index of my book? Boera, Benvenuto Cellini. Mention that a scholar at St. Catherine's, Oxford, named by the name of Kristen Shepherd Barr, is soon to publish her study of The Murkwater, your first play, and The Silver Lotus. Draper's style was to wander away from her Italian lesson, for instance, so a scatterbrained yet relevant vignette would be my thumbnail on your other fiction connected to the theater. Look up Theodora, I can announce, and know that there are separate titles collected under Scenes Behind the Scenes. Theodora is your young American self, dreaming of her breakthrough opportunity in one volume, helping her father out of a difficulty with swindlers in a Colorado mining camp in another. The only fiction of the stage to make it to print is your grand parody of The New Woman in George Mandeville's Husband. There you are in the ultimate cross-dressing part. Ibsen actress takes a pen name and invents a woman who thrives as George Mandeville. Your narrator, who no one will guess as you only go by your father's initials, matching a last name to your younger brother's first name, makes us unavoidably sympathetic to the husband. George abandons her family and dashes off to the theater, where they are adapting her play. Elizabeth, it really takes something to swing from that wild satire and drag to the boldness of what you commit to as fiction with a moral purpose after the suffrage movement awakens you in 1906. Just think, you were going to write a commissioned drama for the actress Gertrude Kingston, set in the time of the great French actress Rachel, performing in the mid-1800s before you were born. prior to your conversion to the suffrage cause, you could write a play that was perfect for an actor manager. You optioned one to Tree and read another to Alexander. After the suffrage struggle won you over, you were still juggling oh so many public speeches, but it was a logical step to expose white slavery in your own way. Partly you owed it to W.T. Stead, who sank with the Titanic, and so you wrote one of your novels that sold and sold and sold, My Little Sister. And this time you seized the occasion to write the book first and adapt it to the stage. How near it was to receiving production. How would you be differently remembered if it had been staged? There were actually two versions of the last act, one that survives from the attempt to job out the adaptation to Cicely Hamilton. She wrote fine works on her own, of course, but William Archer, your editor from your Ibsen days, could not abide that Hamilton stuck too closely to the novel's ending. Even Henry James knew that Daisy Miller and the American needed happier endings when he adapted them to the stage. Instead of older sister narrator grieving for the presumed loss of abducted sister, the narrator's boyfriend bursts on the scene, snatches the drugged Bettina before the procuress in disguise, Greyhawk, and smuggle her out of the country by taking passage on a ship. Charles Frohman believed enough in it to option it for the American stage. Was the reason he never put it on due to the fact that a Rachel Crothers play had drawn only disappointing audiences? In England, it had to get approved by the censor. The Woman's Theatre of Manchester was about to stage it. Then first shots were fired, and the world was plunged into the Great War. And you want me to mention Evangeline as well? Dear Elizabeth, that's one that will have to wait. But it might afford us a look at your attitudes about racial justice, don't you think? If I were forced to use academic language, I could hint that your richer unpublished record with plans for productions and never produced plays supports a complex psyche where melodrama and stardom play against missed opportunities and a feminism that confronted the need for radical reform. Now, if I could say that, with focus on exactly what you did achieve, and, quote, present evidence that these achievements have enduring value, I might just have the first draft of a nomination to the National Women's Hall of Fame. That's my next project. Would that satisfy you?